This is Mary Thatcher on the 1st of July 1981 at Mrs. Lacey's house at Compton near Winchester. She's going to record something of her work as Honorary Secretary of the Baha'i Nerissa National Council of Women and other items, expanding her written answers to the questionnaire. To start it. And can you tell me about your work with the Baha'i Nerissa National Council of Women?
As far as I can remember, it was started by Sir Henry and Lady Wheeler when they came from Bengal, and he became governor of Bihar, which was about 1924. And the National Council of Women in Baha'i Nerissa worked through standing committees. We had a standing committee for primary education, a standing committee for hospital care and amenities, a standing committee for legal advice to Indian women who wanted to recover their dowries when their husbands had cast them off, and a standing committee for entertainments for strictly Purda, to try and persuade the Purda women to come out and take part in things outside their own homes. And then we had, entertainment, hospitals, primary education, health and health and child welfare centres. And the Indian women worked with those standing committees.
Was it designed as a joint effort from the beginning, Indian and English women?
Yes, definitely so. And we encouraged the Indian women as much as possible to come and take part in it. And we had Purda meetings for them, where the Purda women could come and meet their other people. Because the Purda, strictly Purda, saw practically nobody outside their own houses at all, outside their own family. And it was an attempt through those entertainment committees and work parties we had too. For making sort of little children's kurtas, coats and vests and so forth, which encouraged the Purda women to come out and take part in things not entirely in their own homes.
How did you begin this? Did you talk to them about the need?
Yes. And we had educated Indian women who came and talked to them. For instance, Mrs. Darvely, who was the wife of a High Court judge, who was a very educated woman. She was a Maharati, and she talked to the women, of course, in their own language, in Gujarati or Hindi or whatever it was. And there were other educated Indian women who were very anxious to take part and very anxious to help. And it really worked very well that way.
Did you yourself speak Gujarati?
No, I spoke Hindi.
Yes.
And that is a criticism I have to make of my own fellow countrymen in India. That they did not bother, the vast majority of them, did not bother to learn the language, and that so their communication with Purda women, for instance, was practically nil.
Now these women, these Indian women that you were dealing with, were not the revolutionary type, I take it?
No, the revolutionary type would have nothing to do with the National Congress, with the Baha'i Nerissa National Congress women. They started All India Women's League or something like that, which was Congress, and was anti-British and anti-government and get the British out sort of thing. But they wouldn't work with the National Council of Women.
Did you ever meet the revolutionary ones at all?
Yes, I did. To a certain extent. They didn't air their views very much, when they were with government officials and government officials' wives. But there were one or two that I knew were very much Congress.
Yeah.
I met once, of course, the Mrs. Pundit, who was the first woman member of council in the United Provinces.
Yeah.
Brother of sister, I mean, of Pundit Nehru.
Yes.
Aunt of Indira.
Yes.
And she was an extraordinarily interesting and an extremely clever, capable woman with tremendous drive. But I don't think she altogether approves of her niece, Mrs. Indira.
There seemed to be two streams of Indian women, though. The revolutionary ones who had come out of Persia and were working actively. And then the others that you were dealing with to try and make...
You're absolutely right, there were two streams of them, but the time that I'm talking about, when the National Council, in the 30s and so forth, the women's side of the Congress was not very obvious and not very pronounced. I mean, they all agreed with their husbands' views and all their brothers' views, but they didn't express themselves very openly.
No. And what type of English woman joined the National Council?
A lot of the officials' wives, Indian civil service, and the other services too, like the police and the PWD, and the educational service, of course. They were nearly all members of the Council for Women. And they all took leading parts in forming, going like myself possibly, and another English woman, and Mrs. Menon, who was a graduate of Madras University and wife of the finance secretary, and Mrs. Durr, possibly wife, Bengali, also very well educated. We used to go visiting the primary schools in the bazaars of the towns as a committee coming from the National Council of Women, see what the conditions were, see what they had in the way of slates for little things and crayons and books and what the facilities were, and then pestered the local government, the provincial government, to grant more funds for primary education to try and get the rising generation literate.
And how much influence did you have?
Not very much. Perhaps that's unfair. I think the government was very willing and sympathised with the aims, but actually getting concrete results was very difficult. You had to go on pestering and pestering.
Did your influence increase as time went on?
As time went on, the Congress women's side came up very much more, and they discouraged the Indian women working with the National Council of Women. They wanted to enlist them with the All India Women's Congress or something like that, but definitely a Congress organisation. And I met one or two of those, and they were very vociferous, very determined, and in many ways did good, but they stirred up an awful lot of unnecessary trouble.
In what way?
Made the women awfully discontented and unwilling to cooperate with the European women who were trying to run these various welfare things.
Did they make them discontented with their lot?
Yes, they made them discontented with their subjugation in most cases to the husband or to the mother-in-law. Now my husband and I stayed with Mr. and Mrs. Gompaly, both Maharati from Pune, Gudan. He was then Viceroy Secretary when Lord Wavell was there, and we stayed with them in their house in Delhi. He was very westernized and very enlightened in many ways. He was a very high caste Hindu, but he wasn't very orthodox. Now his wife had not advanced anything like to the same extent. One son had married in Bombay, where he was in business, a woman not of his own caste, who was westernized, who was doing a job of her own of some sort or other. And old Mrs. Godbally wouldn't receive her and totally disapproved of the whole thing. The other son married with his wife and small son were actually in the house when Graham and I were staying with the Godbalys. And she was entirely under the thumb of her mother-in-law. She never uttered unless her mother-in-law spoke to her. She didn't sit down to meals with us. She ran round with the household keys, doing what her mother had told her to do. But she was entirely and completely under the mother-in-law's sway. And even with the child, she couldn't have her own say about it. It was mother-in-law who decided everything, what was for its good and what was not for its good. They were mixed. Well, they were emerging. They were still very much mixed up.
Yes. I suppose more influence was gained by the Congress women.
Oh, yes. Very much so. There was one woman in Orissa, Miss Sheila Das, who was very Congress, and she exercised a lot of influence in Orissa, and was very, if you met her, she, by the way, being Christian, a more unchristian woman than I think I ever met, but she was very aggressively anti-British, made things rather difficult sometimes.
What good do you think that your National Council Congress of Women did?
I think it helped enormously to bring the Purdah women out of Purdah and help them to stand up for themselves and to make them see that they could do work outside their own children and their own immediate family. During the war, we had 22 working parties all over the province. Usually the district magistrate's wife, who's probably European, was in charge of it. But the women came out and worked like anything, and a lot of them had never done a thing before outside their own houses. Some public service was unknown to them altogether.
What did the husbands think?
Some of them were slightly disapproving, but most of them were seeing the change that was coming, the educated ones, and gave their rather grudging consent to it, and realised, that it had got to come.
When you say come out of Purdah, you mean literally meet men outside?
Yes, but if they didn't meet men, they came out to Purdah meetings with other women in other families and talked their heads off, thrilled to the bone to hear other people's family views, even if they were only talking about their other people's servants and other people's children. But you can't imagine what a totally enclosed life the Purdah life was for most of those women, because they weren't living in huge extended family groups. They were living married women, probably with three or four small children and their husband, and literally seeing probably nobody else at all, hardly.
What did they think of your lives? Did they ever comment?
No, I don't think they did. They used to be very surprised, I think, at the amount of freedom that we had.
Did they question you?
No, definitely not at all, I don't think. Now, there was one case which was very interesting. There was a very wealthy zemindar landowner in Bhagalpur district, old Tilakdari Lal, not very high caste. He had two sons, Kamaldari Lal and Shamaldari Lal, both of them clever and both of them very well educated. Kamaldari was destined to look after the family estates, and Shamaldari was destined for the ICS, and he got into the ICS. But he had been sent to England, taken to a degree and passed into the ICS through the ICS exam. And the old father saw that when he came back and had to marry at a very young age, that he would not be content to marry a girl who had been Purdah and had no education. So old Tilakdari took a girl literally from the village in which the district in which they lived, sent her to be educated in the first place at convent schools in Simla. Then when she got older, before she was sent abroad, she was formally affianced to Shamaldari. She was sent to England, she was at a convent school in East Anglia somewhere, I don't know where quite, and was westernized, completely out of Purdah, came back, and became officially Shamaldari's wife, and by that time he was had a post, I forget what he was, in the ICS. And she was, she was able to live his life with him and take a tremendous interest in what he did. And she began from totally uneducated village girl. She came over, at the beginning of the war, Shamaldari was Deputy High Commissioner for India in London. And she was over here. Her eldest daughter was being trained as a doctor in England. And she had her son, which they hadn't had before, terrific rejoicing, in their house in Richmond where they lived. And she, at the beginning of the war, she had Indian servants, and she had an English nanny, an English cook, and an Indian cook. And they all worked together very harmoniously.
But this was quite exceptional.
Quite exceptional, it was. There was other cases one knew where the man had been sent to England and educated in England, brought back, say, to Bengal or Bihar, and married off to a woman who with no education at all, but of the right caste. And he was miserable, it was a dismal failure. I knew two cases like that.
Yes.
The wife was unhappy and miserable, and he had no use for her except to produce children.
Yes. Did he then make an effort to educate his own children?
Yes, they were. You know that big school at Dehradun, which was started on the lines of an English public school?
Oh, yes.
And the first headmaster was a Foot. And it was a roaring success.
Yes.
And the Indians fell over, the educated Indians fell over themselves to get their sons into it. And I knew the Senapatis who had sons there, the Durs who had sons there, the Gokhalis. And they were such nice boys, and they were so well educated, well mannered, and you know, really alive to everything that was going on.
And what about the girls? Did they do the same for their daughters?
No.
They didn't?
No. Very little indeed. Very little. I mean, they didn't consider it was necessary really at all.
Now, in carrying on with this National Congress of Women, do you think that you were a leader in it because you had had a more extended education than a lot of the other wives?
I think because I had extended education, I was much less prejudiced. A lot of the English wives were frightfully prejudiced, there's no doubt about it. Rather shrugged their shoulders and, well, you can't do anything with her after all, she's got no education, she doesn't understand this and doesn't know that. No, I'm bored stiff with so and so. They didn't make much effort. And I think they were all, a lot of them, you can't generalise, but quite a number were very remiss in never making any effort to learn the language, because you can't talk to the people. I mean, you can't get anywhere to talk. Molly Walmsley was an exception, absolutely. And did you ever meet, she's now Dr. Archer, who's at the V&A?
Well, I know of her. I've never met her. Mildred Archer.
Yes, right. Always known as Tim. Well, she was another exception. She was a very well-educated woman, too.
Yes. But do you consider that this education, I mean, Lady Margaret Hall, gave you much more insight into India than perhaps other women had? Because you were exceptional in having a degree.
I think a degree in whatever subject you're reading does teach you to think, doesn't it? I mean,
yeah.
It opens your mind and teaches you to assess a situation and people and not just be blindly prejudiced because other people say so and so and so and so. Well, I think it does help a lot.
What was the general attitude? What was your opinion of the other Memsahibs? It's a very difficult question. It's so general.
I tell you, the friend I was talking to last night, she went out to India in 27, unmarried, to stay with great friends who are RAF, and they were in Quetta. And she was there with them, and she went to other army cantonments and places. She then came down to stay with her cousin, Jack Merriman, and his wife, who were Indian Civil Service in Bihar. And she said, I've never realized until I got to Bihar and stayed with Jack and Ida that there were two totally different worlds in India. The army and the forces living in cantonments had no kind of contact with India as such at all. But she said, of course, when I got down to Bihar, I realized that the people living in the districts and so on. But she said, on the other hand, before she got engaged in Bihar, eventually married there, before she got married, she stayed with people that I knew, Indian Civil Service in Patna, which was government headquarters. And she said, I've never met a more deadly provincial suburban crowd in all my life. And I think that was a little bit so.
Did you find that in your dealings with them?
Bits, yes. With many exceptions.
Well, of course, yes.
But yes, speaking generally, I would say so.
Yes. And what were your interests that were different from theirs?
I wasn't entirely absorbed by the club life, you know, and bridge every evening and going down to the club every evening. And then I knew quite well Lady T.S. Macpherson, Thomas Stuart Macpherson. She was a graduate of Edinburgh, I think, and a daughter of the manse, and was very much in with the Indian women and with the National Council of Women. And she influenced me quite a lot because she was a very broad-minded and a very extremely intelligent woman.
Did you get to know any Indian women really well?
Not intimately, no. I didn't. I knew Mrs. Shamaldari Lal quite well.
Was there always a barrier because...
I think so. Because we were the British Raj and they were, and naturally enough, all of them, loyal as they may have been while we were there, were hoping for independence.
Yes.
And so there was that barrier, I think, a bit. But I liked the Indian women very much indeed. They were extraordinary.
What was your opinion of their capabilities?
Some of them were. I think if educated, they were capable of you know, the highest possible. But there's such a tiny minority who had that. Remember that Mrs. What's her name now? Cordelia, was it Patel? You see, the ones who were really developing their potentials had either partly or largely a Western education. The Indian girls in ordinary Indian families did not get education. It wasn't necessary, they just didn't have it.
How much welfare work did you do? Was it all through the congregation?
Well, the only other welfare work I did was when we were out in the district in Muzaffarpur and Ranchi and Patna, Arra. They were the government, the medical side, the Department of Health and Public Services, or whatever it was called, ran antenatal and child welfare centres. And we pressed very much indeed, that was another thing the National Council of Women was very strong on, the training and the registration of what they call indigenous dyes, midwives in the villages, like that couple you were talking about were doing.
Yes.
Because, of course, the standards of hygiene were absolutely nil. And trying to train these women from the villages and giving them the rudiments of what to do as midwives and so forth.